Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Lori Potter. With me at council table is Catherine Van Huven, appearing on behalf of Clark County, Nevada. The question in this case is whether the FAA failed to follow a federal statute designed to protect public safety when it authorized 83 new towers, each 40 stories high, directly overlooking the site of the planned new Las Vegas airport. Now, Congress has told FAA that its job in considering this type of questions is safety. That's the overriding concern of the agency. And pursuant to that statutory mandate, and again, we're speaking of the 1987 amendments to the Federal Aviation Act, FAA should have done two things in evaluating the proposed new 83 towers. First of all, it should have looked at whether those towers interfere with radar. Will all of the airport operations be at risk because these towers cause electromagnetic interference with the safe and effective operation of radar? Second question that FAA should have looked at is whether these towers are so high that there'll be an obstruction to departing planes. Is there an airspace capacity issue caused by sighting these 83 towers in the direct path of departing aircraft, so that the planes have to either fly at a higher slope or go around the towers? Two important safety questions. Did the agency wrestle with these head on and resolve them? No. Here, the agency's action, in the face of internal objections by agency personnel over the effect of these towers, was not to analyze them in detail, not to resolve the internal objections, but to punt. And in the words of the agency decision maker, written in his final decision, was to decide to, quote, just let it go.
Meaning come back later, right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. He said
so
that
all these mites, maybes, will, who knows, come back when you have some more hard data.
Well, I'd say two things in response to that. One, the law is, and the case law is, that you don't deal with the issues, the serious safety issues, after the obstruction's been built. The law is you do the other way around.
Well, this is what I'm really trying to get at, wanted to get out of the argument today, among other things. What really is at stake here in the sequencing of events? At this stage, the turbine project is waiting on the EIS from the BLM.
Correct.
Gosh, we're just full of acronyms today. In the meanwhile,
unlike most days.
Meanwhile, the airport's waiting on the EIS from the FAA. Right?
That's correct.
BLM's been working on it 5 years. Who has the projected delivery date of 2010?
2010 is the FAA's projected date for completing the
BLM
EIS.
Be any day. They've been on it for
That's
5 years.
Correct.
So eventually they'll finish it. So, when either of these, at each stage, when the first one's completed, we'll know more about the project, whether it's going to go forward, whether it has to be changed somewhat. Same thing with the second one relating to the airport, correct?
Well, BLM isn't directly dealing with this safety issue at present.
But whether the turbine project goes forward and whether it goes forward as currently proposed will be resolved or largely affected by the outcome of the EIS, right?
Yes.
So sometime, probably fairly soon, sometimes almost certainly before the FAA resolves its EIS, we'll know more about the final shape of the turbine project.
I think not necessarily, Your Honor. I think the result in this case is instructive and possibly controlling to the BLM. The BLM has to make a determination that the issuance of its right-of-way is consistent with public safety, and it can be expected to look to FAA's determination in this case.
But does it do that in its environmental impact statement?
It doesn't. The environmental impact statement is prepared for the right-of-way, the use and interest in federal lands that the turbine project would obtain, needs
right.
to obtain.
Right.
And part of the criteria for issuing that right-of-way is assuring that
right-of-way, is that the right?
Yeah, it's a right-of-way for
the BLM
over
side.
BLM
okay.
land. Part of the criteria for issuance of that interest in land is a safety determination. And we can expect that BLM would look to FAA's determination on the safety issue we're here on.
But that's outside of EIS. It's another criterion, right?
Well,
EIS deals with what it says.
The EIS deals with the overall project, which cannot...
From an environmental point of view.
From an environmental and safety point of view.
Oh, really?
The final decision on the right-of-way, the BLM issued permission to use land, has safety as a criterion. And we can expect BLM will look to FAA's decision in this matter before issuing that right-of-way.
All right, so if I understood that correctly, I may have been distracted. The BLM has to make a safety determination in its final decision.
It's not a determination,
no, it has to take
per
safety
se.
Into account.
Safety is one of the criteria among many.
Okay.
That's
and
correct.
The environmental impact statement is another one.
The environmental impact statement must
so
be.
They look at the environmental impact, they look at safety, they may look at other things.
That's right.
Okay.
There are other things as well. That's correct.
So the next step is presumably they will have resolved their environmental concerns, and it may or may not require reshaping the turbine project.
True. That's correct.
And if it does, that could affect the concerns of Clark County.
Well, on the safety issue, this case has enormous practical significance, if not a determinative effect, on whether BLM regards...
But looking at the EIS that the BLM's going to issue, suppose they said the effect on birds is going to be too significant. You have to lower the height of the turbines, of the wind mills. That would very much affect the impact on the runway and maybe on the radar.
A different height of turbines would require FAA to look at that proposed configuration.
Right. So you wanted to look at the currently proposed configuration.
The agency must. It's the only one before it. And our...
Well, they're saying it's not ripe. You know, it's not really before us.
But it's very much before the agency for a couple of reasons. One, it has to resolve the safety issues associated with these turbines before the towers are constructed.
Well, what happens if the towers are constructed first? Then what happens?
Well,
Clark County has to move by eminent domain to remove them.
Well, Clark County can't condemn federal land, can't condemn against the United States.
Can it condemn the structure on the federal land, which is not owned by the federal government?
That's not an issue that we've confronted in this case, but as a federal interest in land, I think there's a serious issue there, and I wouldn't want to pose the
you don't give it away.
The county is investing close to 20 years and ultimately billions of dollars in building a new airport in the only location, what Congress has found, is the only location that a new airport can be built. And therefore, it is unwise in the extreme to erect towers that will deprive the county of some of the only available airspace in the location where this new airport can be built. That's why we want the court to remand so that FAA goes through the entire process now and deals with the issue of both the radar and the height obstruction capacity impacts of the towers.
Say, well, we don't know where the radar is going to be. It's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood. And they say, well, we don't want to do the analysis until you tell us where it's going to be. And you say, that doesn't matter, because wherever it is, it's going to interfere.
Well,
then they come back and say, essentially, and that this is not fully articulated, they essentially say, let's assume. Yeah, but if it's not, if you give us a site, we can test it. If you say it's anywhere, we've got to test all over the place. So why don't you wait till you give us a site?
Well, because then the towers would already be constructed, and we'd have the problem.
Wait a minute, the towers would be constructed before you know where your radar is going to be?
The final sighting of the radar is not defined at any place. The time is not defined at any place. What we do know, though, is a couple of things. One, there is a radar location already shown in the airport layout plan for this new airport. It's shown on the airport layout plan, Exhibit 1 of the Joint Appendix. Two.
So would you like them to test that, and if it doesn't interfere at that location, go forward with the turbines?
We want them absolutely to test the radar at that,
but would that
and to go through
it?
The process.
would that be dispositive if the result is no interference at that location? No, you want to reserve in case the location moves, right?
The process would have to, I think, Your Honor, that trying to decide here and now where the locations of the radar will be and what that process will look like takes the court where it doesn't need to and shouldn't go into the technical corners of this issue.
Well, the FAA is saying it's taking them where they don't need to go, which is to analyze every site within some radius, because that site might be the location of the radar.
The reason I think that it's fair to go through the process now, regardless of where the final radar sites are, is that the record reflects, and the only thing it reflects on this question, is that there will be interference no matter where the radar is sited for this airport, given the location of these towers.
Of these turbines, what if, as Chief Judge Ginsburg asked before, as a result of the EIS, you have a very different configuration for turbines?
Then,
but you don't know, right?
Well, Your Honor, then those turbines in that project would go back before the FAA in a separate process. But we're dealing with this process now. It's the only configuration of turbines.
They want to know. They don't want to deal with this process now. They want to know where the radar is going.
Well, that's exactly the problem. They don't want to deal with this process now. It's kind of an agency, get this off our desks.
Because they'll have to come back and do it again.
Well, Your Honor, there is a new airport built in this country once every decade or every other decade. This isn't a big imposition on the agency to deal with the nation's fifth busiest airport in a serious, thorough way. And if they have to do it again because the turbine configurations change, I think that's what public safety deserves. We're not talking about a tower in a cornfield. We're talking about the fifth largest, busiest airport in the country.
Your concern, as I understand it, is that the turbines not be built before this analysis is done.
That's correct.
And the turbines are not presently authorized to be built. No one knows when they will be.
Could be tomorrow.
So what would happen if tomorrow the BLM signs off on the deal and, BLM, and construction schedule to begin in 90 days, and you come back to the FAA and say, now we need to have a resolution to this, because if the turbines go up before the radar, we're going to have a problem, especially if it can't be mitigated with a flight pattern. No, that's the other problem. Pardon me, if it interferes with the radar. Won't they have to deal with it then?
Well, the county, under the cases of the circuit, the county's practical impact is huge. The county loses if it loses the safety issue. The county's options to protect safety are for all practical purposes, gone. This is the linchpin.
If this case is deemed unripe now, and ripe the moment the BLM signs off on the deal, why is that too late for you?
Because there's a 60-day statute of limitations, a 60-day period to seek review. The county sought that review within the 60 days. That's why we're here. There won't be a fresh decision.
Oh, no. If we say something is unripe now, we often say quite explicitly, it will become ripe.
Well, there's no further decision point for the FAA to make that we would have a new point of departure, new point of appeal. But that wouldn't be a decision to this court. It wouldn't be a decision on the FAA's, an appeal on the FAA's decision.
You initiated this process, didn't you, by filing with the FAA?
We filed a petition for discretionary review of the decision that's now been made and will stand, and unless this court overturns and remands it, will not be reviewable.
It expires in mid-March.
It expires. It could be, and we fully expect that it will be extended.
Does that give you another 60 days?
If the identical tower configuration is submitted, it's our position that this court needs to make a decision on the issues before us in order for us to get the process that we're deprived of now.
Is an FAA decision to extend a determination a trigger for you to, at which point you have 60 days in which to file whatever it is you filed in this case?
if this court has not decided, that's totally in the court's control. If this court hasn't decided that,
what we say,
we can start a new process and create a new case. But if the court has decided, then those issues are resolved, and
if
you have affirmed the FAA's flawed process here, that would mean that.
But if we have not decided on the merits, if we said this case is not right now, and then there's an extension decision on March 17th, isn't that an occasion at which you can come back to the FAA?
The county could, yes, Your Honor, but the reason the case is ripe for decision now is that the process that they employed before can be expected to be employed again. It's capable of repetition yet evading review.
Now, has the situation on the ground changed? Has anything happened to advance the development of the airport beyond what it was in the spring of 2006 when you filed?
Investment, substantial investment in the airport, in the process, in developing the plans.
About where the radar will be?
There is a further approved version of the airport layout plan that's in the record. It does show a location for the radar, just as the one before you now shows a decision or a location.
In what record is that?
That's the record that's contained in the airport layout plan, which is in the joint appendix at the very first document.
That document, I thought, was the layout plan that was submitted to the agency.
Yes, that's correct. It is.
Now the planning process is further along.
That's correct, and it's been approved by FAA.
And is that approved by FAA?
Yes.
The location of the radar?
At this stage, that's at for this stage of the planning process, it's been.
When was that approved?
I can't give you a date off the top of my head, but since the date
October 2006.
Since the date of the determinations,
so it wasn't quite taken into account when they made that determination.
Well, it shows the radar just as the one before you. The first exhibit shows the radar location near the terminal.
Is it still the county's position that the radar might be located anywhere and that therefore the agency has to evaluate everywhere?
There needs to be two locations for radar. One of them will be as shown on or near the terminal. Another one will be at an off-site or remote location.
To be determined?
Not yet determined. But the overriding fact is, as shown in the record, unrebutted, that there will be interference with radar no matter where it is sited, which is why we think this needs to be dealt with now, and why the process, if FAA were to go back through this process in response to an extension request or a new request, the process has to be done right. The process was done wrong, as we brought it to you here today. The reason that a decision would redress the county's procedural problem here is that it needs to have a process that's thorough, that involves the county as an airport proprietor, gives it a chance to comment, and that, most importantly, reconciles these internal agency disagreements over whether safety is a genuine concern and problem for the new airport.
Before you go anywhere, why isn't your answer to all of this that the 1-40 line projects that the turbines will violate the 1-40 line in a way that will affect the other airports?
That is, Your Honor. That is part of our briefs. I haven't made that point here today, but it is certainly raised in our briefs, and we have not conceded or dropped that point. We think the major new international airport is a very serious concern, the number of passengers that use it, the number of operations that make it the fifth busiest in the country. But you're absolutely right. We have made and preserved that argument as to the other airports.
And that argument is that the turbines will violate this sight line or this gradient. And I guess isn't that subject to the same colloquy we've had all along about whether the turbine plan will change with the EIS or whether the BLM will approve it? It's the same uncertainties.
Well,
the difference being, I guess, your runways are laid out. Is that correct?
That's right. The runways, of course, are existing and in use.
They're in
At the other airports, of course.
Yeah.
Yes. But there's nothing in the record to indicate that BLM will change the configuration, height, or placement of these towers. They are what is before the FAA.
Was there a draft EIS circulated?
There was.
By the BLM?
There was.
What did it say?
It evaluated the towers in the locations that were here before you on today.
And found no environmental difficulty?
The proposed action and preferred action is to proceed with the towers in this location. The safety issue is one that BLM doesn't take into its own purview. It's one on which FAA's decision is expected to be the controlling decision.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Potter, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Stephanie Marcus from the Department of Justice, and I represent respondent, the Federal Aviation Administration. I think the court has already recognized the main problem here with both standing and ripeness in Clark County's claim. It's that it depends on a chain of contingent future events that are far too speculative to support standing or ripeness at this point in the litigation. BLM has not.
When will it be ripe? Precisely.
Your Honor, I can't tell you precisely when it will be ripe, except that it clearly is not ripe now for a number of reasons.
I know, but...
well, there's...
At some point, it's going to be moot or unable to undo.
That's the problem with... That's why I can't tell you definitively when it will be ripe,
not
because...
for a date, I don't think.
Yes, no, right, what kind of...
What events have to occur?
Right, well, BLM would have to authorize the turbines in the same location and at the same height that they were proposed to the FAA now. That is not clear at all because BLM's final EIS was issued over 5.5 years ago. So there is no, the burden is on the petitioner to show
and
standing.
And then what would happen?
At that point?
Yeah,
well,
how would it get into court?
Well, then if that happened, I mean, the BLM decision would also be an agency decision.
I understand, but that wouldn't get the review of
right,
this.
There, but, Your Honor, if that happened, it would also have to happen in time for construction to start before these expire in mid-March. I mean, these no-hazard determinations all expire on March 17th. The project proponent of the wind farm would have to come in by March 2nd and ask for an extension. So that's less than a month from now. We don't know whether that's going to happen. There are no affidavits in the record saying that the project proponent's going to come in and ask for an extension in the exact same location, you know, same heights.
Well, that's pretty likely, isn't it?
I don't know, Your Honor. I can't say that. And I also...
And if they do, what happens then?
If they do, then the FAA has to decide whether an extension is warranted. And that also is not clear.
Is that reviewable?
Your Honor, I think if I'm not sure that it is if the determination is absolutely nothing has changed, as in the proposal is exactly the same and nothing
and
else in the record
has
changed.
Are they out on the 60-day requirement
but,
then?
Well, they've already, I mean, in that case, if really nothing has changed, I'm not sure it would be moot because you'd have the exact same determination in front of you. It would just last longer. If something has changed, for example, if they have another new plan.
If we said this case wasn't ripe and then they sought an extension and then petitioners tried to, how would they get back into court to seek review of the FAA decisions?
Well, there's still, I mean, there are other problems in the whole line of, you know, the chain of contingencies. I mean, at least you also have the problem with the airport, where there's a whole EIS process going on for the airport as well, and the fine.
That's not answering the question.
Well, I think you would, they could come, I mean, I think one thing we could do is, and you can look and see in March, you can wait and see in March whether. First of all, I think it's not right because the BLM hasn't done anything. If the BLM, if by the time the BLM does something, there may well be some kind of a number of things would have to happen for there not to be another FAA determination. I mean, if the,
it's possible, however, that the government's saying no review, too early, and then too late.
Well,
and that's what I'm concerned about.
I don't think, I mean, if the, for example, if they come in for an extension and Ms. Potter just represented that there's a new plan on file, and I'm not saying the FAA wouldn't grant the extension, but I am saying the agency will look at it when the extension comes in, and if there is new information, then they do a new study, and that's a new reviewable case. Same thing, if BLM changes anything from the no hazard that
what
was done this time,
changes?
There can be, if nothing at all changes,
mm-hmm.
Then you still, I think the problem right now with adjudicating this case is you don't know whether the BLM is going to approve it at all. I mean, they could say no to this. They consider a lot of things that have nothing to do with the FAA no hazard determination, and they didn't just issue a record of decision within 30, 60 days of the final EIS.
Again, it was assuming the BLM is active.
Okay.
And you said if nothing at all has changed, then what?
Then at that point, it's unclear, it is very likely that these no hazards would not still be in effect because you know they may well expire in March. We don't know that now. Or even if they get an extension, that's not forever. I mean, these things are temporary, and at some point the proponent would have to come in and ask, you know, and have a new study done. So, you know, there would likely have to be another FAA study.
Why would they have to ask for a new study to be done?
Well, I'm
only if something changes.
Only if something changes, but they always have to ask for the extension, and it's not just a change on their part. For example, if
the extension's not reviewable, though, right?
I don't think if nothing. I don't
no.
think so, Your Honor.
That's the nub of my concern.
Yeah, but I think what you would have is a situation where BLM. If BLM approves this, you still have other factors besides whether the turbines themselves mm-hmm. are approved in the same number, same height. There are other factors that may change down the road, like, you know, plans that have been submitted. And I know that though they have submitted a new plan, it hasn't been approved by the FAA in the sense that it would mean, you know, it's too early in the EIS process for the airport to officially approve a plan. The FAA does the siting of the radar and designing of procedures for approaches and departures later on in the EIS process because you don't want to predetermine the EIS process. In the EIS process for the airport, they're going to look at things under NEPA that, you know, question about whether the airport should be in its current location, somewhere else, whether a no-action alternative would be the preferred action. So all those things have to be considered, and so it's not until later that you would have approval.
That's not really the way the agency explained it here, of course. I mean,
the agency acknowledges that under the statute and its regs, it does need to take proposed airports of which it has notice into account. It clearly did so here. In fact, it terminated the studies when it found that it initially hadn't put the data in for the Ivanpah Airport. But in doing so, you still need to satisfy the regulatory definition of what a substantial adverse effect is. And in doing that, you can look at certain things for a proposed airport, and we're not saying you would never write a hazard on a proposed airport. You could have a turbine proposed that exceeds the obstruction standard on its face, the 500-foot one, that's, you know, a 750-foot turbine, right at the end of the runway. That you could write a hazard on. I mean, that's very, very different from what we have is a proposed airport 10 miles away.
Now, you do have a computer simulation or
yes, Your Honor.
That says just that, right? This will be an interference.
With all due respect, Your Honor, it doesn't say just that. I know that's how Clark County has characterized it, but what it is this very broad pre-decisional screening tool that the agency uses. It does thousands.
Okay. I understand that's the representation of the
right.
brief.
Right.
What indication is there in the record that the agency then did some second-level analysis that came to a different conclusion?
The evidence is that the Flight Procedures Office, which in our handbook, it's very clear that this 40-to-1 ratio calculation, which has to do with the 77.23 obstruction standard, is that calculation is not done by this broad pre-decisional tool that is sent out to them initially. They do the more detailed calculation, and they use a different shape tool. They have theirs is a
where's that gift. In the record?
That's it. Well, that is in the TERP's order. That it's the introduction to it is in the petitioner's addendum, and we have cited it in our brief. It's in 8260.3b, and it's you can take judicial notice of it. It's an FAA public order. But what in the record?
Where is it? It's not in the record. Not in the appendix.
No, it's not in the appendix. They do have part of the order in the petitioner's addendum, but we have cited it, and it is accessible on the FAA's website, and we've given you a cite to that. It's a long order, but
very long order.
Yes, and it's very technical, as you'll see. I mean, one thing
it's not very helpful.
but in that there are a number of figures in this order, the 8260.3b, and it's volume 4 of that order that's relevant, and they have figures that show the tool that FPO uses, the tools, and it's very complex. There are equations they need to use. It's in the shape of a trapezoid instead of a semicircle, because a semicircle really takes too much in. I mean, normally you're not going to do a departure approach with a sharp right angle right away.
Remind me, where in the decision under review is that referenced?
That is not referenced because this is something that's just known by the agency. And one thing that makes it apparent that is in the record is if you look at those 40-to-1 reports, which are in the record, there are yeses for penetrates 40-to-1 slope mm-hmm. for Gene Airport. Gene Airport doesn't even use instrument flight rules.
Why shouldn't we remand so they can explain this in the way that we usually require administrative agencies to explain their decisions in a reasoned fashion?
Well, and it, the initial answer to that is that because you don't have jurisdiction because
right.
they are standing and it's not right. But if this court concludes that it does have jurisdiction, it doesn't need to remand here because it can tell just by looking at the 40-to-1 tool itself that it can't be, you know, just looking at it on its face, that it cannot show what does or does not exceed an obstruction standard because it has yeses by Gene and proposed
Ivanpah. So you have to look to other to explain this now?
Well, I mean, one thing, you can look, take judicial notice of the
right.
TERP's orders that we've cited in our brief. You can look at those and you can look at the handbook. And we have cited sections of the handbook which show that it's the Flight Procedures Office, not this tool that determines the 40-to-1. And it's, for example, in Handbook Section 6-3-6, C1, it says FPO personnel shall identify when the structure exceeds Sections 7723A3. And that's the obstruction standard that's relevant here.
We could do all that, or we could send it back to the FAA to explain it, right?
Well, I think here...
Isn't that what you're supposed to do? I mean, you're asking an awful lot of...
Well, I think,
me, at least. Maybe the other judges can handle it.
Well, I think when it's apparent on the face of what is in the record, the other thing is that the flight, you do have in the handbook something that said it's flight procedures that does this analysis. Flight procedures here did note a possible IFR effect. I mean, they were obviously mm-hmm. paying attention mm-hmm. to this. They made a comment about radar. They said nothing about 40-to-1. I mean, that when it goes back to them, they don't, you know, as we pointed out in the brief, there are 50,000 of these studies that the FAA does a year, and so they can't document every negative. I mean, we should presume that government officials here will do their job,
but
and
you're
they...
asking us to presume from the absence of any indication that they did, that they must have.
Well, I think because right. they clear... it is clear you have the... It shows the divisions looked at this, the Flight Procedures Office...
But whether they looked at it or overlooked it is not obvious.
Well, I think... Your Honor, again, I think what when you have a study like this where none of the obstruction standards was penetrated, and here it is documented over and over again in the record that the FAA looked at this and found no obstruction.
In other words, they didn't.
They did document that.
The FPO did not issue a finding of obstruction, right?
Right.
And from that, you want us to infer that FPO studied the question and came to a reasonable conclusion.
Right, well, we're just, I think that's, there would be, no one, the petitioner isn't alleging that FPO didn't do this.
Remember back in grade school when you did arithmetic and they said, show your work?
Yes. Well, I mean, again, here, we, to put it into the context of having something like 50,000 of these, there are also certain things, for example, Henderson Airport is 20 miles away.
Explain the 50,000, the relevance there. So you're saying that this will be such a burden on the agency to do this?
Well, it's that the tool is so broad. I mean, do they, for example, would they really need to document that they wouldn't even need to use the tool for Gene Airport, for example. So I don't know why they would, their documentation that they found that this didn't exceed 41 is the fact that they said they didn't have an objection on that ground because Gene Airport doesn't even use instrument flight rules. So if you imposed a requirement that they would have to paper every single thing like that when this tool has a yes by it, that would impose
But perhaps in that circumstance, saying Gene doesn't use IFR is a sufficient answer for not going forward and doing any further analysis. It's not
but what we're saying, but the fact that Gene doesn't use IFR. Henderson does, it is 20 miles away, though, from the proposed wind turbines, and that is something that, you know, the departure, it's...
Well, nonetheless, the report was that it breaks the 40-to-1 plane by more than 35 feet.
Right, yes. But that, again, that's with using the very big semicircle...
That's the first cut.
Right.
Then the second cut is missing, and then the conclusion is, no, it doesn't.
But the pre-decisional tool is just to say, you know, look, this is a possibility. It may.
Okay, and what negates the possibility other than the absence of any further indication?
Right.
Any further evidence in the record, one way or the other?
I think it is, you know, taking, it is recognizing that a couple of the yeses there clearly for the obstruction standard itself should be knows, which are the Gene Airport and proposed Ivanpah, and also looking back to the alleged injury here.
No, the answer Gene isn't no, it's that it doesn't matter.
Well, it doesn't violate the obstruction standard because the obstruction standard has to do with
it. Penetrates, where the yes is where it's whether it penetrates 35 feet.
Right, but the obstruction standard pertains to instrument flight rules. Procedures.
Maybe I'm looking at the wrong yes. The yes I'm looking at is just breaks the plane by more than 35 feet.
Right, but the break, that's not the obstruction standard.
I understand.
Okay.
That's the first cut.
Right.
Okay. And then it's a sufficient answer to that, I suppose, to say, well, it doesn't matter. There's no IFR
right.
at
right.
the gene, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
Now
yes.
tell me about Henderson.
Right. In Henderson, it is sufficient that. Again, that it went, you know, you went back and they did not say, oh, you know, after looking at this, we see that there an obstruction standard is penetrated. And also, with respect to that, you can look at how far away Henderson is. It's 20 miles away. It would be very, it is, you know, when you're thinking about an airplane departing or approaching and these, their wind turbines 20 miles away, I mean, I don't, in that situation, it would be, you know, highly unlikely that you would have a problem. And I would note that Clark County said nothing about Henderson in either its petition for discretionary review or its affidavit. And there's a reason for that, because they don't think, if they thought they were injured or there was a problem with safety at one of their existing airports, that presumably would be in the declaration or in their petition to the agency for discretionary review. And it's neither place. So, you know, they threw in a reference to it in the brief, but it's not, that's not where they're asserting injury.
Your brief gives a somewhat different set of answers.
Mm-hmm.
Among them, this is a 42. Mm-hmm. With respect to the proposed IVP airport, as mm-hmm. yet there are no established minimum instrument flight altitudes for approaches or departures.
Right. That's right. That's part of the, and that's for that. I thought you were asking about Henderson, Your Honor.
Switching,
and that's the other problem. Well, that's why we were saying that for that's.
But you acknowledge elsewhere that you have to deal with planned airports, right?
Yes, and there are certain things you can't do, and that you cannot document.
When would there be establishment in the ordinary course of such things, when would there be established minimum instrument flight altitude?
I don't think that would happen. No, but it would happen much later in the EIS process.
Well, after the turbines are up.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think that we have no idea if and when the turbines will ever be up. And so I wouldn't say that either. I mean, they've now been waiting 5.5 years.
Am I correct that the handbook refers not to the obstruction standard, but to the 40-to-1 slope?
There is a provision of the handbook cited by our opponent, which talks about the 40-to-1 slope. And they are using that provision to say that all these procedural requirements kicked in. But they left out in the brief the context of it, which is the sentence before it talks about the TURP's orders. This is in the handbook, and it's in petitioner's addendum. Yes, it is tab 14. And it's handbook section 6-3-9E4.
I don't have tabs with me.
Yes. So it starts by saying departure procedures, TURPS, and then references the specific TURPS order. And it says contains criteria for the development of IFR departure procedures. An obstacle that penetrates the 40-to-1 departure slope is considered to be an obstruction to air navigation.
That's problematic sentence.
Well, it's a problematic sentence if taken in isolation, but, Your Honor, it's right after they're talking about TURPS being used to determine this, and it's the TURPS orders that have the correct 40-to-1 tool. That is what actually determines. And this is, of course, with respect to approaches and procedures that have been designed. I mean, that's another thing, Judge Ginsburg, that you correctly noted, that here, when you don't have a departure designed at all, then it's not going to, you know, violate an established minimum. But even assuming you did, that tool in the 40-to-1 reports, the semicircle, is just a very broad pre-decisional. It's used for screening. It's useful for things like, for example, if you look at it, I believe there were no's by McCarran Airport. That at least takes away, the Flight Procedures Office doesn't even have to look at McCarran then, because this is going to sweep in everything that's relevant, you know, that they even need to take a look at. And that's why they use it.
Well, now, there are established, whatever they are, departures, patterns, or something.
And approaches.
At Henderson.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So why isn't that sufficient to create a need for further analysis?
Well, you know, again, I think that if you can assume here that it, when it got that, yes, would trigger a flag, you know, that goes back to FPO and they can look at it. And if you look at, you know, the obstruction standards, they're imaginary surfaces, for example, and 77.25, they're not going out, the surface that you look at for these, they don't go out 20 miles. So they, you know, if they felt they needed to because of the configuration, they would use the trapezoid tool in the TURPS order.
How far out does the 40-to-1 slope project?
I'm not sure exactly how far out it projects.
I didn't realize it had a limited.
Well, we're talking about whether something or not is an obstruction for approaches and departures. And, for example, as we note in our brief, that circularization is not required for airports that are more than 13 nautical miles away. And there's a reason for that, because it's not usually a concern if you're more than 13 miles away.
How far away is Henderson?
20. And I also, again, I would go back to Clark County not raising in their declaration any injury to, you know, their safety concerns at Henderson. They didn't raise it in the petition for discretionary review. And I'd also go back to the fact that FPO, if there were a problem at Henderson, they would, you know, write down 40-to-1, you know, penetration, and there would be something noted on the division responses other than just this IFR note that they do have in responding to these studies, and that it was documented a number of times, including the person handling the studies said there are no penetrations, clear as a bell. This is not even a close call with this. So I think, you know, here...
Is that a quotation there?
It's a quota, yes, it's a quotation, and we cited it a couple times in our brief. It is in the...
That's in the email?
Yes, it's an email from Bill Merritt, and he also had some notes, Merritt's notes, which are in the joint appendix, and I don't recall which, off the top of my head, which quote is from which one.
In your 50,000 point, I still want to get back to that to try to figure out, you're worried, explain the concern that they're going to have to be more of a formal document, I guess, in 50,000 cases each year? Is that what you're worried
about?
Well, I didn't really explain that 50,000 to me.
What we mean by that is that if you're going to use a pre-decisional tool, which people, you know, and here we are asking for some deference in our interpretation of our own rules and our handbook. And these are the experts who analyze highly technical data. As you'll see in the TURPS orders, they're using equations and diagrams that, you know, are beyond lay people like me. And I think here the problem is they will know, you know, they just know just looking at these tools and using them, you know, whether something is going to be a problem or not, and to have them document obvious to them knows. It may not be obvious to us, but
so
it's
a highly
technical area. So in the
end, the argument's really just take, you know, they don't have to explain it, they just have to check a box.
Right, and that the checking the box means they looked at it. I mean, here, they checked the box. They said, clear as a bell, no penetrations. And they documented, they had detail reports that said no, it didn't exceed any of the obstruction evaluation standards. They also got division responses. I mean, it might be different if you had a study where we couldn't even show divisions responded or looked at it. Here, they very clearly did look at it.
Well, and there's disagreement, right?
Well, that has nothing to do with the 40-to-1,
right,
which is one of our points about that. But yeah, in those, but those, as we pointed out, were there was one objection and one just note of an IFR effect, and those did have to do with the radar at the proposed Ivanpah Airport, and they were phrased, you know, the IFR effect comment was phrased about future, you know, a future problem, and then the other one used the word, you know, proposed several times, or. And they were speculative in nature on their face. And then the person managing the study asked for documentation and support of these objections. And from one person, he didn't receive, you know, any support or backup from that. And then from the other person, actually said, I would not anticipate the instrument approaches planned for the proposed Ivanpah would be impacted. However, I certainly cannot say for sure, looking that far down the road. And I actually think that supports the agency's position here. And there are layers and layers of speculativeness in this, both on the jurisdictional
issues.
Let's
back on the jurisdictional.
Well, and on the merits. I mean, I think that part of the merits point is it's too speculative. You have a standard here that, you know, and remember the FAA is going to be subject to challenges on the other side of this too.
If you
issue a hazard determination, the project proponent can come quote back the substantial adverse effect regulation and say how did you meet this? And when you have radar that hasn't been sighted and when you have procedures that haven't been designed yet, it would be impossible to defend on these facts. Now, that's not true.
Usually the way you try to defend it is to provide some explanation that's more than just a couple emails scrapped together. I mean, that's, you know.
Well, but these are, you know, these are.
I mean, at the end of the day, the legal question is really, can we just take a box checking as sufficient to comply with the APA?
Well, it is more than just box checking here.
Here we have the emails.
You have emails saying that.
I think your point was that just box checking would be good enough because they're experts.
Well, and box checking I think would be good enough where you don't have the objections. I mean, here you needed the emails to show that someone actually saw the objections, responded to them, gave the employees a chance to respond. If you have your standard does not exceed, the FAA has pointed out it doesn't circularize those. I mean, it has thousands of these, and a lot of them are just very uncontroversial.
How many exceeds but okays are there?
You know, I don't know.
In the same passage that says There are no Part 77 penetrations, clear as a bell.
Yes.
The author goes on to say, the wind turbine could very possibly impact some facilities in the future, such as radar.
Mm-hmm.
So why is that just dismissed?
Because of the having to find the definitions of substantial adverse effect and determining adverse effect, which can be found in that handbook. To have substantial adverse effect, you have to have electromagnetic interference to the operation of an air navigation facility or the signal used by aircraft, or if there's a combination of adverse effect and a significant volume of aeronautical operations. And then adverse effect, you either have to have exceeding obstruction standards or is found to have physical or electromagnetic radiation effect on the operation of air navigation facilities. And what FAA is saying here is you can't satisfy that, you can't prove a physical or electromagnetic radiation effect when you haven't sighted the air navigation facilities yet. You haven't sighted radar, you haven't designed departure procedures, you haven't designed approaches.
Well, they had a proposed site in the plan.
That's right, Your Honor, but it is too premature to use that definitively. It's just proposed. It's the agency, that actually does the siting. You know, with input, the agency certainly will accept input and suggestions, but it's the agency that does it, and they would do it later in the EIS process because. Remember, there's an EIS for the airport here, and so you wouldn't want to site the radar before you figured out what your preferred alternative is for the airport, because you're considering a lot of different factors about where things should be and what, you know, the best idea and what the best alternative for dealing with, the excess of capacity for McCarran. I mean, they're going to consider a number of alternatives in the process. So they,
if the proposed alternative, the proposed airport goes forward,
mm-hmm.
is there any reason to doubt that the proposed radar site will be the radar site?
I think it's not clear because there are a number of different places you can put radar, and because it's down the road, there's not even a final EIS scheduled to 2010. We don't even know what kind of radar
it'll be.
What
do you make of the statute that tells you to take into account?
Again, Your Honor, the agency takes into account everything that it can without being speculative, and things that would penetrate an obstruction standard. Again, I give you an example that you could have a really huge radio tower or turbine or something that was over 500 feet. It just on its face would penetrate, it would exceed an obstruction standard. That's not a do not exceed determination like it is here. And if it does so with respect to a proposed airport, that may well be a hazard. And if it's also located right at the end of the runway, not 10 miles away or 20 miles away, I mean, there are definitely hypotheticals where you would have something that would be a hazard to the proposed airport. The problem is with radar, since it hasn't been sighted yet, you can't fulfill that statutory definition and the regulatory definition, which is taken from the statute. So I think here it's different when you just, you know, when you don't have something actually sighted there.
Thank you, Ms. Martin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Several points raised by counsel that I'd like to respond to. First of all, the argument made by FAA would render the 1987 Act amendments a nullity. The direction that FAA look at planned airports in evaluating safety and capacity was enacted knowing how long it takes to build a new airport. If you don't look at them at the time.
Isn't the agency given some leeway to say when a plan is sufficiently concrete or in the offing to make it practical for that to apply?
I think not the argument that they're making in this case, Your Honor. I think their position contravenes the 1987 statute. You can't protect a planned airport if you say, well, that's planned, so we can't deal with it. And that's what their position boils down to.
Well, if the plan were just someday we're going to build an airport. There's been an airport plan for south of Chicago to relieve O'Hare for 30 years.
Well, this is an airport in which Clark County has purchased 6,000 acres. It's spent the last 8 years, and as the record would show, tens of millions of dollars working on it. It's doing everything it can do to develop this new airport. The record also shows that...
No, I understand that, but I've given you an instance where the timeline is much longer. And at some point, surely the FAA can still look at that and say, these are cornfields, and you're so preliminary in your planning that we can't waste resources on them.
Perhaps so, Your Honor, but I think that's a very different case. I think none of our facts are on all fours or even on twos with that. I think a very different case. I'd also like to know that counsel, note that counsel conceded that there's no review of extensions. We have to get this process right this time. And what we're asking this court is not to go back and be able to sort through whether they used a trapezoidal shape and whether they looked at the 40-to-1 correctly, but to direct it to use the procedure that is provided in the statute and in the handbook. The regs are obsolete, haven't been revised, but there is a procedure. They didn't follow it. We're asking the court to send this back to FAA to do the procedure, show your work, as Judge Ginsburg remarked, show your work. Much of what we heard from counsel is post hoc rationalization of what the agency did. We don't see the agency's explanation that she gave in the record before us, especially with respect to the highly technical data regarding the terp sort or the trapezoidal shape, the secondary tool. Counsel directed us to look at the terp sort for how the second level of analysis got done. That terp sort is not site-specific to this site. It isn't a decision about this case. It's a generic order that applies to FAA broadly. What we're looking to see, and looking, quite frankly, to influence and be involved in, is how that calculation gets done, how the county's concerns get taken into account. As the proprietor of five airports, the county knows aviation in this topography in this area, and it ought to be involved in a process that, frankly, is not reflected.
You're not saying you know it better than the experts at the FAA, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think that perhaps on site-specific issues, the county does know better. It has a Department of Aviation that does nothing but run five airports in this geography, topography, with this traffic and air traffic, and it is, I'd say, the FAA's equivalent on certain issues and knows those issues as well or better as FAA, and it deserves the kind of process and involvement that the statute, the 87 statute, was specifically drafted and enacted to address.
Thank you, Ms. Potter.
Thank you.
Ms. Marcus, thank you. Case is submitted.